My phone may ring, and I'm going to quickly answer it. The fellow's going to show up who was supposed to be here 45, 50 minutes ago, and we'll get him to hook up. So maybe we'll have amplification by the end of it, but thank you for sitting down low. I'm going to charge of this shindig. It's not a proud moment at the moment because of this kind of stuff, but it's wonderful to be here. Welcome you to Session 11, which is Imagining Mormon Studies as Part of a Wider Religious Studies Curriculum. We have two terrific speakers. Many of you here are familiar with Peggy Fletcher Stack. She has been a longtime friend of Sunstone, one of the early co-editors, and then eventually the editor. We did an article recently where she was Mrs. Sunstone. Is that kind of how your life for a while went, this complete identification with that, until a handsome volunteer at Sunstone named Mike Stack came along, and she decided that there was more to life than Sunstone, and so she went on and did all the wonderful things, eventually going on and becoming a reporter, religion writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, which is where she is now. She and Mike live in Salt Lake City and have three children who are all getting grown up, and we're just grateful to have her speak here to us today. She's going to talk about an article and the research that she did that recently appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune about Mormon studies, specifically the difficulty of doing it in Utah and some of the themes that sort of match around why maybe perhaps outside of Utah is the place where Mormon studies can be done the way other religions are studied within the academy. And that sort of leads us to our second speaker and the second half of this topic today, which is the Claremont Graduate University's plans eventually to create a chair in Mormon studies and to begin a Mormon studies program to whatever degree that they're able to as funding and things come through. And we have Ann Taves, who is professor of History of Christianity and American Religion at School of Vermont School of Theology, as well as professor of religion at CGU. She graduated with her bachelor's degree from Pomona College, which is one of the Claremont colleges here. And then she went on to the University of Chicago, where she got both her master's and her doctorate in religion. She specializes in the historical and theoretical investigation of religious experience and practice. She's the author of amazing number of books. Look how young and productive she is. She's just amazing me. But everything from The Household of Faith, Roman Catholic Devotions in Mid-19th Century America, to Religion and Domestic Violence in Early New England. Her most recent book, which has been very well received, is called Fits, Trances, and Visions, Experiencing Religion and Explaining Experience from Wesley to James. And her new book is called that's in the works is called Spirit Possession and Modernity. So a very productive scholar working in some really fun areas. She's on this panel today as the faculty representative for what's called the Council on the Study of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which Claremont has established in an early effort and an outreach effort to establish ties within the community and the college that will eventually lead to some sort of Mormon studies here. So she'll be able to talk about all those things. I'm grateful for Ann. She was on my dissertation committee when I graduated from here, and she signed it, so yay. She was just great to work with, lots of fun, and we're just appreciative of having her. So we're going to turn the time over to Peggy. This microphone here is just for taping purposes, and again, we'll try to get some amplification sometime during the session, but certainly by before too long during the day. So thanks. Peggy, I'll turn it over to you.
I still have to speak into it. This topic of Mormon studies and how to do Mormon studies has been interesting to me since I started working at the Tribune in 1991. One of the very first stories I ever wrote was about a one-day workshop in Utah for public school teachers on how to teach about religion in schools. They needed a workshop to figure out what was appropriate to say in a public school setting and what was not appropriate. And a guy named Charles Haynes from the Freedom Forum has been to Utah many times to teach teachers about how to teach religion. It's his view that if you can do it in Utah, you can do it anywhere. If you can succeed in keeping teachers from either proselytizing in the classroom or bashing religion in the classroom, then you've succeeded. So I wrote that story on my first summer of 1991. Also wrote a story the very first year I was there about how Utah is one of the only states in the U.S. where you cannot get a degree in religious studies. None of the public schools, none of the private schools, nowhere can you get a degree in religious studies, which I found at the time and still find astonishing that a place so steeped in religion, not just Mormonism, but every religion is in Utah. And people talk about it at cocktail parties. People talk about it, you know, it's the, as you're helping your neighbor unload the van, moving van, you say, so what religion are you? I mean, it's just so everywhere. And to not be able to get a degree in religious studies seemed to me to be just amazing. I've written that same story probably five more times in the almost 13 years I've been doing it, culminating of in this recent article that we wrote, my friend and I wrote in February, about it was launched because of an attempt by the University of Utah to hire a replacement for a very popular history teacher who had focused on Utah history, Dean May, and he died unexpectedly. In looking for a replacement, they really did want somebody with some background. It's not religious studies, it's history, but they wanted somebody with some knowledge of Mormon history, specifically as it plugged into Utah history. They interviewed Mike Quinn and decided against hiring him, but I guess in the midst of the conversations, there were some things said about the value or not about studying Mormon history, which we used as a reason to write yet another story about the lack of religious studies in the state of Utah. I interviewed several of the people that were on the committee to decide whether to hire Mike or not, and some of them did say things to me like, you can't do it in Utah because you'll offend the Mormon legislature, which is where we get our money, or you can't do it because it will seem to be promoting Mormonism, or you can't do it because you can't even-handed. They had a number of reasons why it was impossible to do in the state of Utah, none of which I found persuasive, because I said, okay, welcome to my world. This is what I do every day. I have to be able to write about religion in a neutral format so that I don't take sides in the debate. I don't...
Want to hold it? Too high?
Okay. Studies is a very... The attempt to talk about religion in a neutral way as an observer, but who nevertheless takes people's religion seriously, is basically my job. I will just give you a couple of examples of how I've had to do this just very recently. For Easter, I decided to focus on Eastern Orthodoxy because this year, Western Christianity, Eastern Orthodoxy celebrated Easter on the same day, so I took it as an opportunity. You know, I'm not going to hold this. I took it as a chance to write about... let's see if we can... Okay. So I was writing about this Russian Orthodox group that I have been wanting to write about, and they were telling me about the miracle of the holy fire at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is a phenomenon that happens, so they said, on Easter, or around on Easter weekend, where the patriarch goes into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and... he strips down to just a tunic, goes in there, gets searched, and at a certain point he has a candle, and it is lit miraculously from heaven, and
and then spontaneously liked all of the candles of the other people. It's a kind of a blue light, as he described, and it's such a miraculous fire that you can put your hand in it and don't get burned. So I write this in my story, according to this priest, and in the text of the copy editor wrote, "I don't believe any of this." And I said, "Well, welcome to my world. I don't necessarily believe it either, but this priest does, and it's part of their faith, so let's write about that." And quote him, not me. The second problem, so that there's the question of how do you write about experiences that you haven't experienced or that you might not believe yourself, but you know that a certain group of people do. How can you write about that with fairness, even-handedness? My Mormon readers will accept miraculous stories from their tradition, but if I write about, as I did, tarot card reading, no, that's to them not legitimate. So I say, no, we have to write about both of these faith experiences equally. The second problem is that it's my job that's very similar to academics that would be in this field, is the problem of advocacy of religion. The perception that if I am sympathetic to a particular faith, then I should be converted to that faith. And I will just tell you one little experience I had with that. When I was working on my children's book, I took each page to each group and asked them to read it and critique it. And when I took the page to the Muslims, I was at the mosque and I read it aloud to a group of men, so women were nowhere to be found, and read it out loud. And the imam said to me at the end, "Oh, that was so beautiful, that was so wonderful. You could not have done that by yourself. Obviously, Allah helped you." And I said, "Oh, thank you, then. I appreciate that." And then he said, "And if Allah helped you, then you should be Muslim." And so I was like, "Well, no, thank you." But I was flattered by that. But you see that connection in his mind. If you write sympathetically or you can get inside someone else's faith, then you should convert to that faith. And I think those are issues that confront people in religious studies all the time. For my article about Mormon studies that I wrote in February, I interviewed Phil Barlow. He is a professor in the Department of Theological Studies at Hanover College in Hanover, Indiana. He described it to me as a small liberal arts college founded as a Presbyterian college, and it's still very Presbyterian related. And he was the first non-Presbyterian in the Department of Theological Studies. And there was some suspicion of him, as he is LDS, and he had written a lot about LDS history and theology. And I talked to him about the problem in general of writing about or of discussing religion in that setting. He said that the most important thing he does at the beginning in his classes is to establish trust with his students. He says, "Before I get to any topic that may threaten their understanding of their own faith, especially in a kind of a survey of American religion that he does," he says, before he gets to any such topic, he has to establish that he's trustworthy, that he is not intending to attack their faith or to undermine their faith or to take it away from them, but to explore it in more depth. And he said, many of them come in hostile to the idea of studying religion at all. They are, as he put it, inerrant Bible believers. And the study of religion, just the study of it, is a little threatening, he said. He said, studying religion academically is an art, and they need to trust that he is a worthy leader in that. He talked to me about, I love this metaphor he used. He said, he looks at the study of religion, there are two ways, as biography and as autobiography. And most believers think that their autobiography is the truth. The way their faith should be portrayed is the way they see themselves in it. And he has to persuade his students that there's nothing wrong with autobiography, but it's not the same as biography. And I love that, that sort of metaphor he used. And he said that eventually people are accepting of him and his approach, and they work through some of the tensions and issues together. I also talked to Kathleen Flake, who another LDS scholar who teaches at the Divinity School, Vanderbilt Divinity School, and she talked to me about how, again, how can this be done in a classroom situation? She said, for it to work successfully, you have to have a few things going for you. First of all, it's really important to have religious diversity in a classroom. It's much, much harder if you have all one group, or largely one group of believers in the classroom. It's best if you have people from a variety of traditions. And secondly, you kind of need the as she put it, the disciplinary training to hold religion at a distance while you examine it. So it's academic discipline, training, the mental training that comes with any sort of study is really important to have that at the beginning. And she says that that is often missing. It's very hard to accomplish at an undergraduate level. Much easier by the time people are graduate students, they do have more of that academic mental discipline to be able to hold things apart and study them. She said, Latter-day Saints are trained not to describe their faith, but to advocate it. So when you have a classroom made up largely of Latter-day Saints, the issue of advocacy becomes a huge problem. She said, a lot of undergraduate students who are taking religious studies, they're taking it to understand the faith of their parents or the faith out of which they emerged. Mormon students, on the other hand, often come to religion, the study of religion, thinking they already know the story, and they want to just come in to the class to debate the teacher or to, you know, they... and this grows over generalization, but in general, she said that they like the idea of debating and proving that they know more, or that, and thirdly, she said the question of authority arises, which is, well, what is your, the teacher's authority to know these things? And they might argue that their religious authority is a more powerful way of knowing than sort of more of a scholarly academic. And she said this presents, you know, lots of issues. And then she said that she would have a hard time. She has a hard time, she said, when there's LDS, when she has LDS students in her survey of religion classes because of this need to debate all the time to receive the sorts of her perspective on things. And she wonders about being in a place like Utah where you would have many Mormons and they would come from a variety of perspectives about their faith, and they might get involved in a, you know, debate with each other and take the topic away from its focus. And on top of that, she said, in Utah, the politics of the classroom are hard enough, but the direct relationship between those politics and the capital P politics, meaning Utah, you may not know this, but Utah legislates. represent the whole additional problem. When I was talking to the University of Utah professor about my job and said, look, I have to do this, why can't you? And he said, yeah, but you are privately owned, you are not in danger of losing your job or your funding. I said, well, we lose readers if I tip one way or the other. But he said, yeah, but we have, you know, we have a very different funding issue, which is not to be minimized. I would say, despite all of that, I would say Mormon Studies is coming of age. And for Utah not to do it, because it's difficult, it simply will be left in the dust. Other places will do it, as we wrote. University of Wyoming is setting up a chair of Mormon Studies, not a chair, but an emphasis in Mormon Studies. Utah State University is seeking faculty to teach Mormon history and some Mormon studies. Utah Valley State College is putting together a whole program, possibly religious studies, that is getting underway. And Arizona State University has Doe Daughtry is teaching a class in Mormon Studies. When I talked to Doe on the phone for my other interview, she described what sounds to me like a remarkable class setting. Yes, it's fraught with all those same problems as Kathleen and Phil talked about, but listen to some of the things that they talk about in the class. They talk about how does Mormon identity get constructed, eternal gender roles, how the church educational system works, how correlation program works to bring converts into the whole program, the Book of Mormon, history of theology, the way history is conveyed through storytelling traditions, testimony, power and authority, women's issues, embodiment, homosexuality, the welfare system, globalization. I mean, this sounds like a very exciting, interesting class. We had to talk to her about how successful it is. I know she was telling me some of the same challenges she faces as Kathleen was describing, and certainly is true in Utah. Certainly some of her students in Arizona are LDS, and they would have those same advocacy issues and debate needs. And yet, through the process of using academic tools to get through to this whole program, I think young people would come out on the other hand side of the class, understanding and examining their own faith in a new way. In conclusion, I just want to say that whether church members like it or not, whether Utah schools like it or not, the Academy will study Mormon history, sociology, beliefs, and practice. Phil Barlow said, Mormonism is like a magnet for scholars because it's foreign enough to need interpretation and complex enough to demand the most sophisticated scholars if it's going to be done well. It won't be easy in Utah for all the reasons I mentioned, but it cannot be avoided any longer. Phil said, the lack of a fully developed program in religious studies and Mormon studies in the state institution of higher learning in Utah is an absence that echoes out beyond the Inner Mountain West. For comparison, try to imagine the absence of Jewish studies in New York City or Jerusalem. The feelings about Mormon studies run in strong and contrary directions in Utah for obvious reasons. Those who pioneer in the effort, no matter how judicious, will not be able to avoid criticism from one side or the other any more than the governor of a state can avoid criticism. The project of Mormon studies will require not only deep learning, but also wisdom and sensitivity to and respect for religious and cultural commitments of diverse types. It will demand diplomacy, balance, courage, honesty, and a thick skin. But difficulty ought not to be confused with impossibility. The capacity to examine itself is a mark of a mature culture. And that is my final conclusion, that fraught with problems though it is, it's actually quite an exciting time in the development of Mormon history and study of Mormonism. To think that we've come far enough to, as a people, to be able to examine in an academic way our faith, and that others who are not Mormons are also interested in examining Mormon faith and practices and culture. It's very exciting to think that it has enough staying power and enough interest and enough maturity that it could be the subject of all these burgeoning programs. And I, for one, am very excited by this development and hope to write more and more about the unfolding programs as they come. Thank you.
Okay, I think I'm totally surrounded by microphones now. I really appreciate Peggy's comments, and as by way of response and also introducing some of what we're talking about here, I would just like, first of all, to second some of the things that she said and elaborate on them a little bit from my own perspective. I think what she said is excellent and sits very well with my own view of the situation. In light of some of the struggles that have been going on in terms of establishing or hiring people in Mormon studies in Utah, I would just start by emphasizing the difference between hiring somebody in a history department and hiring somebody in a religious studies department or forming a religious studies program. Most history departments would approach Mormonism from a somewhat different way than it would be approached in religious studies. In a history department, it would typically be integrated into the history of, say, the American West or American history. There would be less attention to the internal life of the tradition in terms of theology or religious practices. It would be much more in terms of the role of Mormons in the history of the state of Utah or the Intermountain West, that kind of question. And so it would be much more related to economic history, social history, that kind of thing. In a religious studies program, ideally anyway, a religious studies program would have multiple traditions represented by in terms of the faculty teaching. And so Mormonism would be one among many traditions studied. There would typically be a comparative kind of emphasis. There would be an examination of the internal life of the tradition, both its theology and its practice, as well as the ways that it's interacted with other groups and the whole range of issues that Peggy was referring to, for example, in the Utah State kind of course that you were hearing about. So in some ways, I would say it's easier, even though the University of Utah just failed to hire somebody in their history department, in some ways it's easier to hire, it's less controversial in many ways to have somebody doing Mormon stuff in a history department in a more narrowly historical way than it is to have a full-blown religion program set up. I think that brings additional sorts of questions that history departments usually don't wrestle with. And I do think that it is probably easier to set up a full-blown religious studies program in a context outside of Utah or outside of a Mormon-dominated area, or actually to set it up in any context that's pluralistic than in a context where you have a single tradition that's dominating. So this isn't something about Mormonism or Utah. It's about how do you implement a religious studies approach which is inherently, or at least ideally, comparative, involves multiple traditions, and it involves students learning to think about traditions other than their own alongside of their own, or, to put it the other way, places their tradition alongside others, which is not the typical approach of that's usually taken by the traditions themselves. And so most theological schools or religious education programs run by denominations or run by traditions, and my understanding is that, for example, the way that one would study the Latter-day Saints at BYU would actually be not unlike the way we might teach about Protestantism at the School of Theology, where we're training ministers. I mean, one's undergraduate and the other's professional training for ministry, but those would probably be in somewhat of a similar universe. But when you switch over to a religious studies model, you're not preparing people in the same way to be leaders within the tradition. You're preparing them to teach, usually, predominantly, in contexts where, again, the assumption is that multiple traditions would be and that they're being trained to help people wrestle with that multiplicity of traditions in a comparative kind of way. So I think that there's certain uphill battles or complexities about bringing religious studies into a context like the Intermountain West, where one tradition is the dominant tradition, where either in schools run by the tradition or in the state-sponsored, the public colleges and universities, where again the legislature plays a major role. I mean, to compare, for example, at the University of North Carolina, there was a big reaction from their legislature a couple years ago when the university assigned a book on Islam for all the entering freshmen to read. And that's a legislature where evangelical Protestantism would be fairly heavily represented. And the thought that the whole entering class as part of their general humanities education was going to read a book on Islam created a firestorm within the legislature. The university held its ground, but it has a long history of doing that. And so it seems to me that's the kind of level the diversity of Utah or the other state schools would have to be. They'd have to be prepared to really mount the defense of this kind of humanistic education in relation to religious studies. And I certainly agree with Kathleen Flake's comment that teaching a religious studies approach is dramatically aided by diversity in the classroom. And so, again, you get less of that if your main student population is being drawn from an area that's more homogeneous. So here in Claremont, we've got two things going for us. One, we've got that our School of Religion in the graduate school has a formal commitment to engaging with a plurality of religious traditions and is actively working to diversify our offerings at a variety of levels to be able to do that better. And second, we draw both nationally and regionally, and therefore from a highly pluralistic pool of students. I mean, the LA Basin is literally one of the most diverse places in the whole world. So it's very much in contrast to the Intermountain West, and I think that, and that's something that we're consciously trying to deal with, engage, and reflect. And so that puts our students automatically in a different kind of position. They know they have to deal with a multiplicity of traditions because they see it mirrored in the surrounding environment. They see it mirrored in the classroom. And so they're already grappling with that issue before we even bring it up in the classroom. And it seems to me that that's a huge advantage. And then when we bring it up in the classroom, it also means that they've got to deal with each other's perspectives. And those are both religious perspectives and non-religious perspectives. And so that makes it infinitely easier on the professor. My personal beliefs aren't usually an issue because the situation isn't polarized between me and the students. It's not the same as if I were a non-Mormon teaching about Mormonism in a context where most of the students were LDS. There, automatically, you're going to start to get a polarization between the professor and the students. In a situation where the students are all different, whatever the professor is doesn't come into play nearly so rapidly. And I can then use my own professional training to help the students adjudicate the differences between themselves and figure out ways to take on that sort of discipline to be able to look at whatever tradition we're looking at or to compare two traditions or to deal with religious versus non-religious interpretations of various beliefs and practices. So I can teach, in many ways, in a much more sophisticated way when they're already having to deal with that pluralism because it's in their midst. They already see the problem. They're suffering, so to speak, from the problem. So I can bring in a solution as opposed to causing the problem. And I think in the situation that people are wrestling with in Utah, the professor or religious studies is seen more as causing the problem as opposed to solving the problem. So maybe one last thing that I would say on this sort of theoretical level is that Peggy talked about advocacy, which I think is often what people wrestle with in theological education type programs, you know, what's the best way to do that. Issues of description and analysis, which are foundational to religious studies programs, especially at the undergraduate level. Well, they're foundational at each study. But I would want to add one further level that is sometimes introduced at the undergraduate level, but is really more of an advanced issue. And that's wrestling with explanations. And explanations of religious experience or religious phenomena come in all kinds of flavors. Obviously, believers explain religious phenomena in religious terms, in terms of internal explanations of their tradition. There are a variety of theological explanations of religious practices or phenomena that take into account the plurality of traditions. But there are also a variety of secular explanations that come out of anthropology, sociology, the social sciences or social theory. I think it's crucial, especially at the graduate level, that students wrestle with the whole range of explanations. And I have to say, just sort of, this is anecdotal in terms of the Claremont situation. As we've been engaging, well, maybe I should save this story and come back to it after I tell you a little bit about what we've been doing in Claremont. Dan mentioned that I'm the faculty representative to the Council for LDS Studies. Our dean at the School of Religion has set up a whole range of councils. There's councils on Islamic studies, on Catholic studies, on Eastern Orthodox studies, on Zoroastrianism, I think. And I mean, there's half dozen to a dozen, and I don't remember what they all are, but they're in Hinduism, at various stages of development. They're all working with community members, leaders in the area, in these traditions, working largely on development efforts in an attempt to diversify our faculty. And so the LDS Council is working towards this chair in Mormon studies. And the way that we can see that is that we're hoping to hire someone, if we get funding for this chair, who has basic broad training in American religious history, who would join me basically as another person teaching American religious history whose specialty would happen to be in Mormon studies. And so they would teach some advanced courses in Mormon studies, but they would teach a range of broader courses where Mormon studies would be one tradition among others, whether in an intro course on American religious history or a more specialized course on some sort of theme where Mormonism would be set in relation to some other traditions. Here, I will just give you a brief plug for a conference that we're holding next spring, which will include a couple of people that Peggy was actually talking to, and gives you some idea of the way that we're approaching this. It's called Positioning Mormonism in Religious Studies in American History. And we're going to have 5 sessions. The first one is specifically geared toward an LDS audience. And we're going to have Grant Underwood from BYU, he's a LDS historian, come and give a talk specifically for a Mormon audience basically raising the question of is this safe, Mormon history and the academic establishment, where he's going to talk about the academic approach to Mormon studies, talking about it for an LDS audience, sort of to prime them to be able to enter, to go to the conference and freak out. So then the conference proper is going to have 4 sessions. The first one is going to be positioning Mormonism in religious studies. Well, actually, let me explain the broad picture. Each one is going to be highlighting a different discipline within the academy: religious studies, American religious history, literary and cultural studies, and women's studies and women's history. We're going to have a scholar who specializes in Mormon studies, but who also positions themselves within a wider field, talk about the assumptions within that wider field and how those assumptions have shaped the way that Mormon studies is incorporated into that larger field, critique those assumptions, and talk about if those assumptions were different, how Mormon studies might be incorporated in new and different ways. And then we're going to have a panel of respondents who are in that larger field talk about, so what do I think of this new way to think about our field? So the first field is going to be religious studies, and Kathleen Flake, who's at Vanderbilt, is going to be talking about this, the assumptions that have tended to govern the way that religious studies has been incorporated into the field of religious studies. And then we'll have 3 people from the wider area respond to that. The second one is going to be positioning Mormonism in American religious history. Phil Barlow, who again Peggy was talking to, is going to be the presenter for that session. Terrell Givens is going to present at the 3rd session on positioning the Book of Mormon in literary and cultural studies. And Catherine Danes from the History Department at BYU is going to speak on positioning Mormonism in women's studies and Western history as the 4th session. So we hope that that's going to be an interesting sort of conference. I worked with some of these scholars and also with Jan Shipps, and I'm having a senior moment here. Yeah, Richard Bushman, you know, so well known I can't find his name right now. In terms of planning the conference, and this was something that they felt would really advance the discussions in a way that they would find exciting. And so I think it will be good for both people in the field and of Mormon studies and in the broader field. So anyway, to return to my anecdote, as we've been engaging with all these councils, all of whom are believers, right, mostly on the councils. And I've started to envision this newly rebuilt school of religion with all these exciting new positions and this influx of people from a variety of traditions, both students and faculty, who have a stake in these traditions and yet are working at all these comparative questions and everything. I've been having this sense that I really had to crank up my own interest in keeping the secular perspectives in the mix here, that we are going to get so many believers that I was going to need a little bit of relief by moving into the non-religious approaches and being able to do that in a way that people didn't just see it as attacking or threatening, but how do believers seriously engage with non-religious perspectives on the traditions that arise, especially when you get into comparative situations? I mean, the more you compare things, the more you start to think, there may be some naturalistic explanations for some of this stuff, and we don't always need to, you know, move to theology. Anyway, slipperiness of all these concepts and how things like religious studies and religion and mysticism and magic and all these terms are very fluid and don't have nice, clearly marked boundaries. And so you've got to be very careful just in how you set up what you say you're going to be trying to explain. And then I'm going to run them through a whole variety of explanations that scholars have been coming up with from anthropology and social theory and cognitive science that in one way or another come at these phenomena that have variously been labeled as religious experience. And I figure in that way, Joseph Smith can be included in among the people who are discussed, along with a whole bunch of other examples, in a way that I can't imagine people are going to feel like Joseph Smith is being picked on in particular. he's just in there among everybody else, and, you know, everybody is getting equal treatment. And so that would be my sense of how we get sort of to the most difficult level that some people would find the most threatening without any particular tradition feeling unduly picked on, because it's really equal opportunity explanation here. So I guess that's about it for...
We have just a couple of minutes. Who's got a question? I've got a microphone here. That's kind of cool that they weren't wireless for us. But if you have a question, we can just go a couple of minutes, and then there's going to be a little setup problem for the next one. We're going to have to...
I'm just thrilled to know that all this, but what other divisions are there already in your department?
Divisions in terms of...
You want to add Mormon studies.
Okay. The School of Religion at Claremont has historically gotten a lot of its faculty from the School of Theology. So there's been a heavy emphasis over the years on what you might call, broadly speaking, Protestant studies or a Protestant studies approach. So we've had Hebrew Bible, we've had New Testament, we've had history Christianity, we've had philosophy of religion and theology. More recently, we've added women's studies in religion, theology, ethics, and culture. American religious history is pretty new, and that's much more in a religious studies model, which is somewhat new for Claremont. The development push that we're going on now is probably going to lead to a reconfiguring of our programs. And faculty have been talking about that. We've got a lot of initiatives going right now on comparison that are trying to get our faculty up to speed in terms of thinking about what they do in relation to other traditions and other ways to approach it. So we're coupling our external development efforts with internal faculty development, because we don't want to create a school of religion that just has a bunch of sort of stovepipes of, you know, I do this, you do that, they do the other thing. We really want to create an interactive environment among the faculty at the level of the scholarship and teaching that is what we hope will also then be reflected in what the students learn.
Yes.
Well, in fact, we've got quite a few Catholics on the faculty right now. We have Jewish scholars on our faculty. We have faculty from the Claremont Colleges who participate in the religion department, who teach Islam, who teach Buddhism, and who are Muslim and Buddhist. So we have a fair amount of variety when you count people from the undergraduate colleges, but we want to get more diversity in our faculty at the graduate level.
Thanks very much. That's the end of our time. So please grab these fine people.